Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast dedicated to creating a living social history book about street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world. Quite dull, I would say. That would be quite a dull reading of the text. It's not words I would ever say. I can't imagine saying crazy characters in real life.
Matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plans well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Nor the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
It's much more difficult to do the type of comedy I was doing, which is really character-based, and they've got to get into you, and they've got to know what you're about. Because I would go out and do nothing, no tricks, nothing. You know, I knew how to juggle things and ride on a unicycle, but I wouldn't dream of doing it, you know. People were like, no, you need to have an act with a beginning and a middle and an end, and I actively avoided that.
John Feely is an anomaly. He has no business card. He has no website. He doesn't even have a promotional reel. And in a world where so many people seem content to go with the flow, he's the sort of guy who very deliberately goes against traffic to avoid the certain death he sees present in following the crowd. As a daring solo performer, John cut his teeth in the West Piazza of Covent Garden, then went on to become a brilliant collaborator with groups like the Heffalumps, the Florists, and the Uncles. John now spends much of his time working in palazzo shows in Europe as both a performer and director. Today's interview between Busker Hall of Fame instigator of big ideas Lindsay Lindberg and John Feely was never really intended for release. Instead, it was a pre-interview meant to gather information about John for another recording that was scheduled a week later. We opted to go back to this original conversation because of its spontaneous nature and because, in spite of 2 decades of street experience separating them, these two shared a great connection while exchanging their views on the world of busking. Now that's the power of Stories from the Pitch.
Hello, hello.
Hi, John, it's Lindsay.
Hey, Lindsay Lindberg.
How's your day going?
Very nice weather, actually. The first decent day's weather we've had here. Very lovely, went out on my bike, and very pleasant.
So we are having a chance then, because the sound got quite buggered up, then you and I are going to start from scratch. And it's kind of a really great opportunity because I don't know you yet.
No.
Literally, I hope it's not offensive, but what do you do?
comedian. Okay. When we're coming to actually do the interview, David Akin's going to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He tells me.
Yeah.
Because at least he knows me a bit. I knew him when he was a kid, and we did the same gig in Australia, and he's seen me. So at least I won't feel quite as pathetic as I do at this moment right now. What was the question?
You're a comedian. Have you always been a comedian, or do you juggle as well? Did you have, what was your kind of specialty?
When I was a kid, like 6 or 7, I started doing magic. That was the first thing that, you know, resonated with me, that made me go, oh, this is something. And so the first time I performed, it would have been doing magic. It was always comedy. It was never not comedy, but magic was the first kind of thing I hung it on, you know, was magic tricks.
Were you like a hidden in the closet kind of magician? Was it one of those things that you didn't necessarily tell people about, or were you one of those, I'm going to go do all the birthday parties I can find in my neighborhood?
No, I never did a birthday party in my life. I've never performed for children. I've never done any of those things. For me, it was, as it is for a lot of people that get into magic, as I'm sure you know, a lot of people that get into magic get into it in lieu of having any social skills, you know, because if you can't talk to anyone, you can go, oh, pick a card, look, and it's a way of beginning to communicate. But very quickly, I kind of thought, this is not good, is it? Because you have to get past that. You have to get past tricks. That's not what it's about. You know the way some people say that when you get people who are naturally musically gifted, for example, and they'll look at a piano keyboard when they're kids and it just makes sense to them, and they kind of go, oh, and they see it, and you get Mozart writing symphonies when he's 8, and it just seems ridiculous. But for some kids, that just makes sense. And other kids will look at the keyboard and it'll never make any sense. In the same way that some kids will play sport and other kids don't. And for me, you know, I remember watching Laurel and Hardy when I was a kid, and just watching Stan Laurel and being very aware of that that's only funny because it happened at that point. And if it had happened 2 seconds later, it wouldn't be funny. Mm-hmm. And the timing thing, which is the thing that everyone talks about when they talk about my thing, is just always been innate and intrinsic. And it's like music. That's my thing, you know. Not that you would get it. See, if you see me, this would all make sense, but I feel like I'm now projecting my thoughts onto you and you're going, well, who the hell is this guy and why is he? But, I, you know.
I don't think that. I'm absolutely into this. This is good stuff. So how old were you when you were watching Laurel and Hardy?
Oh, when I was a kid, 6, 7, you know, as long as I can remember. And not just Laurel and Hardy, but Laurel and Hardy used to be shown a lot on television when I was a kid. But I'd never seen anything live. I'd never been in a theater or anything. And was massively, massively introverted. And I remember being like 9 or 10 in school. And I kind of slowly became aware that I had some sort of wit. But I was so painfully shy that I couldn't. Like, the teacher would say something in school, and I would immediately think, oh, that's the funny thing. But I would say it to the kids sitting next to me, who would then say it out loud and get a laugh. Mm-hmm. But even as a kid, I remember thinking, yeah, but the timing's wrong. It needed to happen when I said it then. It's why are they laughing? Because it's the wrong timing. It's like 5 seconds out because, yeah. So I'm trying to think was the first time I kind of... I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? I remember doing the street show for the first time, and that was kind of painful and terrifying and heart pumping and terrible, of course. You know,
yeah, they always are.
Oh, there's no shortcut, is there? Yeah, I remember that London, like 1980, 81, around that time, and that's the first time I saw a real street show where you go, ah, that's what you can do. I didn't know you could do that. Mm-hmm. That's possible. And that was this guy, Randolph the Remarkable, Phil Herbert. It was just character. He was a huge guy, big fat guy, and he dressed like a sort of Arabian knight, curly slippers and, you know, waistcoat with nothing on underneath and a turban, and did nothing. He would have a plastic washing up bowl, and he would fill it with water, and he'd say he's going to put his stomach into the bowl of water, and he'd have people examine his stomach, and he would explain what he's going to do. He's going to put his stomach in, lower it in, he's going to arch himself back and push all the air out and create suction. This absurd big fat man putting his belly into this bowl of water, and he would kind of arch back and the air would come out, and he would stand up and the washing up bowl would be stuck to his stomach. You know, we have suction. And later on I got to know Phil, and but he was, you know, he's a gay guy and very camp. He did that. I think at one point he lit a little torch and put it out in his mouth. But it was like, it was the first time I saw somebody do 45 minutes with big laughs and structure. And that was the first time I thought, ah, okay, you can do that, that you can do that. And then I went to Covent Garden and it was just starting up then. And in those days, just the mere fact that there was somebody outside doing a show was a mind blower for people. That what's this someone's doing? And it was good, was a mind blower. The fact that this guy's a funny guy. And in those days, it was the absolute variety of... And I don't care, but I really don't want to come over as, you know, some old reactionary old fart. But the diversity was so much more back then. And nowadays, it's, you know... It's not. It tends to be a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy, and the original thing's gone. You're looking at this black mess, and it's just a copy of a copy of a copy. But in those days, it was people who were funny, not people who went, ah, so that you say that, and that gets a laugh, and you do that, and that gets... But without any feeling for it, it was a load of funny people. And people not funny, people doing things that were not funny, magic acts, mimes, and it wasn't just about comedy. But, yeah... I think that was the thing that made me go, okay, this feels like something I should be.
So it just felt like home, like yeah, people.
It just felt endlessly fascinating. And of course, all of those things about, you know, yeah, but how do you get a crowd? How do you get a crowd? And I mean, I always went for the hardest way. Not because it's the hardest, just because when I was talking to Nick, I'd kind of forgotten this, but Nick had reminded me when I talked to him. He remembers when he first saw me in Covent Garden. And Covent Garden's a big old space. It's a, if you don't know it, it's a big pitch. It's daunting if you've never worked there. And people would go out and ring bells and nah, nah, nah. And I used to go out with nothing, with like a matchbox. And just be this character and not being overt, not kind of following people and trying to, but being in my own world and very intense and not understanding why these people are in my space. And I would take this matchbox and I would take one, it couldn't get any more minimal, you know, I'd take this match out, you know, and I would play with this match and then eventually I would strike it and I would push it onto the ground and it would kind of oxidize. Mm-hmm. So now there's a match kind of sticking out the ground. I would look at this match and I would take another one. I would do two and I would measure the distance between. And slowly this crowd would gather. And Nick was, I just couldn't believe that, you know, you'd gone onto this massive space with a box of matches. And I would make a line of like 10 matches or something, by which time there was a few hundred people watching. And then I would just kind of gesture them to come forward and they'd come forward. And I would start the show and never refer to the matches again, you know. I always started shows silently, always, even though I'm a very verbal performer once I start. But it's about creating an atmosphere and the freedom of that, the freedom of, because I wouldn't do that all the time. You know, sometimes I would find something and I'd go, oh, we can play with that. And I'll go out and play with it. And I sound like an idiot. I apologize.
You're absolutely great.
Obviously, it's much easier if you go out and ring a bell and go, show, we're going to do a show. But what's the point? It's much more difficult to do the type of comedy I was doing, which is really character-based, and they've got to get into you, and they've got to know what you're about. And it's much harder, because I would go out and do nothing, no tricks, nothing.
What was the end of your show, then?
Whenever it was time for the next act to go on. No, it was...
You're kidding! You didn't have a finale at all? How did you get people to give you money if there was no, like,
That was an irrelevance, because it was about learning. It's about developing as a performer. And I just saw, if you're going to keep doing the same thing every time, how well can you develop? All you can do is get very good at doing those things. Well, that, I don't want to do those things. And of course, people at the time, a lot of people would go, you know, it would send them crazy because I'd do these shows where people would be screaming with laughter and there'd be massive reactions and I'd make no money. But I could do all those things. I knew how to juggle things and ride on a unicycle, but I wouldn't dream of doing it, you know. People were like, no, you need to have an act with a beginning and a middle and an end. And I actively avoided that. And it's funny because those same people that said, you've got to have an act are now, you know, well, I don't know what they're doing, but they're not doing very well. And because I kind of avoided having an act, and I still don't have an act.
But you work pretty often then.
Yeah. I do really nice gigs. You know, I don't have a website. I don't have a business card. I don't have a Facebook. Skype is a huge leap forward for me. I have no presence. I have no web presence. I don't have a business card. Because people see me, you know, people see me. Like that Zinzani gig, I was in Edinburgh, and I hadn't done a street show for a few years, and I directed two shows that were up there that were doing very, very well, really well. And I was broke, and it was so weird because these two shows were getting like 5-star reviews, and I was penniless. And so I thought, oh, I better do a street show. And this guy was in the audience, who was a director at Zinzani, who came over and said, I think you should get in touch with these people, and gave me the card for Zinzani, and I went, thank you very much, threw it away and never bothered. And then I bumped into him like a week later, and he went, have you phoned those people? And I said, no, of course not. And he said, no, please phone them, because I've phoned and told them that you should be. And so I emailed them and said, hey, this guy told me to get in touch with you. And they emailed back saying, okay, can you send me your DVD? And I said, I haven't got a DVD. I'm not in. Forget it. It's okay. I'm not interested. And they went, no, but he says you're really good. And I went, I am really good, but I haven't got, I'm an improviser. What do you want me to, I could send you a DVD of me doing something, but you don't know that that's me. I said, if you want me, invite me over and I'll do something for you. And so they said, okay. And so I went to Seattle and I flew in on the Wednesday. I saw the show on the Thursday. I was in the show on the Friday. And that's all weird because they go, what are you going to do? And I go, I don't know. And I didn't. I genuinely did. I genuinely went, okay, I'll just go out and see what happens. And but I really mean it. It's not like I went and did that bit. And that. I didn't do any bits I'd ever done before. I just started talking to people and dig stuff up. And they went, great. Can we offer you a contract? And I suppose that's what I mean by the road less traveled, because obviously most would be sending videos and going, can you please book me? And I'm kind of going, I'm not interested really. If it's right for me, I'll do it. But if not, I'll do a show on the street. You know, it doesn't matter. It's not, you know.
Well, so how long did you stay doing Zinzani? For one show?
No, I did a season there, but then what happened was the guy who had seen me originally, he left Zinzani and he went to become the artistic director of this company Palazzo. Do you know who they are? No.
I think I've heard of it, but I really don't. I can't.
So you go to www. I guess the young people don't say www. I still have to do www.palazzo, palazzozzo.org.
Okay. Okay. Wow. Beautiful.
So, yeah, the Spiegel tents. And I play the chef in this show, you see. Because it's a dinner show, you know, it's like a three-and-a-half-hour thing with unbelievably good acts. And I directed this show also, actually.
Oh, wow.
Why am I showing you this? Oh, yeah, because the guy from Zinzani saw me and invited me to go to Zinzani, then left and became artistic director of this company and said to me, come with me, come with me. And so that was like show number 8 I've just done for them, this Amsterdam show.
Wow. Do you love it? Do you feel like this is where you're supposed to be?
It's interesting because they're a bit like everything I've ever done. They're a bit like street shows, you're surrounded. They're a bit like stand-up, I don't use any props. You know, they're a bit like theater. They're a bit like circus. They're a bit like everything I've ever done. Yeah, it's interesting. But it's weird. So, for example, these sort of gigs, these Zinzani and Palazzo, people are kind of chopping their arm off to get these gigs. You know, they're sending DVDs and phoning up and all that. And I just kind of, I've done nothing. And
you won't even return phone calls like at the beginning.
I don't. I, you know, I get bored very, very quickly. I have a very low threshold of boredom, you know, and which is why the street show thing. So I did all these solo shows for years, but then eventually the thing that I did for a long time was collaborations with people, and I put stuff together. In like 1990, I did this show called The Florists, which it was only for 1 year, but, you know, I remember Robert Nelson saying, well, that's the best show there's ever been. It can't be any better than that. You've got you doing the comedy. You've got Sean Gandini, who's like one of the best jugglers in the world. You've got this acrobat, and I've got a drummer, and it's my structure and all that. And I remember him just going, well, that you've done it. You've done that's it. It doesn't, that's the ultimate thing, isn't it? It's a huge thing, and it's everything. And I did it for a year and then went, no, I had enough now. And then people kind of go, what are you doing? That was, yeah. And then I worked with this guy, Alex Dandridge, and we were the Uncles. And again, that was a bit of a landmarky street show. And everyone was like, well, that Florist was great, but this is even better. And then we worked that for like 8 or 9 years, and then we stopped. And these are the same reasons why I don't kind of live anywhere, because I just, the idea of... I get bored very quickly, and it's a problem, and I acknowledge it is a problem, but I just can't, you know. Austin sounds quite interesting. I think I might come to Austin.
Find me. I'll hook you up.
I get really bored. You know, it's all about the work, essentially. It's about the work. It's got to be work that I can stand behind and go, not that I do go around saying, isn't that great? But it's about the work. It's only about the work for me, really.
Hmm. Well, it served you quite well to follow your heart, as far as, like, integrity. I mean,
oh, yeah, no, 100%. 100%. There's a lot of burnt bridges smoking away behind me, you know, because I just kind of say, no, thank you. But, I, you know, having said that, I haven't really done anything on the street for a while, I have to say.
Are you having an inkling to go back?
I haven't had an inkling for a while. I have an inkling. No, it's funny. Not last summer, but the summer before, I got asked to do some poor sod that has spent months trying to track me down eventually found me and said, come to Portugal and do this thing. And Nick Nicholas was there. I hadn't seen Nick for years, you know. And it was this guy, Luis de Matos, who's a famous magician. He's like Portugal's David Copperfield, you know, he's on television and he's a famous guy. And he organizes these street things. And I said, I haven't done magic for a lifetime and I haven't done a show on the street on my own for 25 years. And I went and it was just fantastic. I'd forgotten how lovely it was working at night time and yeah, lovely, lovely. But for example, these Palazzo shows I've just done, I direct the thing. I have 100% creative control of the whole thing. I choose what songs the band play and I choose everything. And they trust me to do it because I know what I'm doing. And there is a beauty on the street, of course. But doing it day in and day out, more and more I would become aware of what's not there rather than what is there. You know, I would start going, that would be so much stronger if there was a little spotlight there. Or if I was doing this with a band behind me, that would be great. Or, yeah, I'm never going to be happy. So, you know, the grass is always green and all that stuff. But I can't remember when it was, a year or so, a couple of years ago, I went through Covent Garden and it was terribly depressing and dispiriting and no funny guys, you know, no funny people. People doing jokes and comedy shows, but no funny people, no people with, you know, no. Do you know who Chris Lynham is? He's a great clown. Chris the Piss, he used to be called. One of the great ones. I was talking to Chris a few days ago, and he was saying, yeah, he went back to Covent Garden last summer. And Chris is, you know, he's like me. He's worked all over, and he's had TV shows. But he thought, yeah, I'll try and work on the street again. And he's like, it's just depressing. It's just really depressing. Covent Garden specifically, rather than the street as a form. Yeah, it's just very, very depressing. And certainly for those of us that remember the way it used to be. Again, I'm sounding like an embittered old sod here, but
everything's changing and has changed. It seems to me like even the places that used to be the biggest names in the biggest cities, they close, it changes, it transitions, and nothing can ever be what you remember it. It can't. No. It's impossible. No.
And it is a societal thing as well, because now every shopping mall you go in will have some tattooed idiot with a chainsaw, and so people go, oh, it's that thing. Mm-hmm. And so you have to break past that, and especially the way I work, where I go out with nothing and a suit, and people have now got this 6-second attention span. Well, it's no good for me. They need to kind of get into me and see what's happening. And it doesn't mean I can't do it. I can do it, but I have to work so much harder to do it. And I don't go out there and start talking about money as soon as I've got a crowd, which is just so vulgar. You know, it's we used to do the show and we finish the show and you take a bow and you say, thank you very much. This is what I do for a living. I hope you enjoyed it and thank you very much. And people would come forward and put their money in, you know. And this get up high and put music and it's so poor. It's so poor. And these same fools who do this nonsense have got the audacity to kind of say, did you see the latest Woody Allen film? Wasn't that terrible? And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? What are you talking about? What do you do? What you do is nonsense, but you surround yourself with other people who do similar nonsense so you can all convince each other that you're not doing nonsense. But if you actually take a breath and step away, it's nonsense what you're doing. It's nonsense. And it's the road to nowhere. It's the road to nowhere because they marginalize themselves. They get more and more tattoos and more of this crappy mics that they use on the street. And like all the people from my generation of street performers, not all, but a significant number, went on to do theater and television and film and writing. And because it wasn't about, I have to be a street performer, a busker. I have to look at how hard I am and look and all that nonsense. But it's good because their own life is their punishment, you know, because at a certain point they're going to go, where can I take this? I haven't got an act because my act is putting music on, getting people forward, come forward, come forward, money, 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 do some crappy trick. And if you put them in a proper venue, you don't need to put the music on. You've just been introduced. You come on. You can't get them to move forward. They're not going to give you money. There's nothing there. For example, these Palazzo shows, you've got world-class jugglers and world-class acrobats and got beautifully formed acts. And if you stand next to them, you see it for what it is. It's nothing. And you never learn to perform because it's all about come nearer. I don't know why I'm saying this.
No, but it sounds like if I were to put it into one phrase, it's, is it now for love or for money? And it seems like what you're saying is,
yeah,
back in your day, it was for love, and now it seems to be more of just a cash grab.
Yeah, but it's a love of performing, of finding different ways to perform and different ways to connect with people. And even if at the back of your mind, someone's thinking, I think this is all crap. I think this is all, I'm going to try something different. They'll try something different. And of course, it won't be successful. And so the other guys will go, oh, you didn't get any money. And so they go, oh, I can't do that. And you've got to be really strong to go, I'm doing my thing. I don't care. You do whatever you want. I'm doing my thing. I remember in the 80s, I went and did this. Where was that? In Toronto. They had this vaudeville on the street kind of thing. I got invited to do it, and a couple of English people. But it was mainly Americans. Robert Nelson was there, and there was a guy called Dana Smith. It was my turn to do something. And I'm kind of waiting for everyone to go. I don't want to go out to anybody. I want it. Nothing, you know, and I'm kind of waiting, I wait, and then people kind of get bored after 10 and they go, and I go, okay, now I can do, and I go out and I'm standing there, essentially I've started, but I am not doing anything, but in my head I'm here now and I'm sort of owning this place. And I remember Dana Smith, who's the sweetest man in the world, you know, who had no idea who I was, never seen me work, and he just thought, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. Obviously he doesn't know what he's doing. Did not get that I'm playing the part of somebody who's a little bit alien to this place. And he came over. He had no idea he was walking, because to me, I'm in my world now, you know. And he just walked over and he said, hey, you want me to shout you up a crowd? I'm okay. And my friend, Andre Vincent, who was used to be a street fan, was there, and he just said, Dana, just watch. And he just sort of pulled him. And then slowly this thing happened, and this big show happened. And Dana was like, I've never seen anything. Oh, that was unbelievable. Because he, from, you know, that American culture of show, big show, showtime. And it was just interesting to see people who'd gone, oh, because it looked like you didn't know what you were doing. That's the point.
That's pretty awesome.
Oh, that's a big glass or a tiny woman. I know, one or the other.
It's time to do the dishes because that's my water. Yeah.
I think it might be Rich Hall used to say, you know, it's time to do the washing up when you find yourself eating cornflakes out of a frisbee with a shoehorn.
That's really good.
I think it's a Rich Hall line.
And disgusting too.
But it's really apt because you do find yourself, well, that'll do, that'll.
Oh, totally.
I mean, certainly if it just helps one person go, oh, okay, so you can go like that. Because I've been feeling I want to do that, and everything I look at tells me I'm doing the wrong thing. If one person goes, so you don't have to be another asshole with a website. You don't have to have a microphone and a chainsaw and a big pole and a whip. And you don't have to. Okay, because I thought you had to do that.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, they had the 30th anniversary of Covent Garden becoming, because Covent Garden used to be a fruit and vegetable market, and it closed down in the early 70s. And it's amazing. It's a huge piece of prime real estate, and for years it was just empty in the middle of London, right in the center of London. And then in like 1980 it opened up as a market, and shops came, and then street performers came. There used to be a Covent Garden community theater that used to put on events out there, and so they had the 30th anniversary of that, and so I got invited to come. I said no, of course, but I but
they should have asked you four more times and you might have showed up.
I used to drink a lot, and I haven't drank for 12 years, but when I was drinking I probably would have done it, but not now. But it was interesting because one of these guys, kids, who's one of the sort of street performers who's there now, it's kind of weird because I remember one of these kids had, they're not kids now, but they're in the 30s. But one of these guys had said to me, I wanted to learn how to juggle, and I was 13 or 14, and I asked my parents to take me to Covent Garden, and I remember seeing your show. I think it was the Florist show with other people. And so some of those people, they literally, they saw me when they were children. And so at the back of their mind, they know it's possible. This kid was saying to me, because they all use microphones now in Covent Garden, and I said, well, you know, I never used a microphone, I never would, and he went, yeah, but you've got to. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you've got to because there's so much noise. And I said, well, there's no more noise than there used to be. It's not like the audience have got microphones. There's always been a balcony of people talking and there's always been traffic noise. There's always, there's no more ambient noise than there was 30 years ago. It's the same mentality that says it's okay to do what people refer to as standard lines or standard material. And the only reason why it's standard is somebody created it and somebody stole it and then somebody else stole it and somebody else stole it. And they go, well, if those 10 people have stolen it, I'll be the 11th person to steal it. It's still theft, whether you're the 10th person or the second person or the first. It's still theft. It's still not you. It's still not coming from you. And it's that same mentality that says, well, if he's got a microphone, I've got to have a microphone. If 10 of these acts have got a microphone, I've got to have a microphone. And you go, if there's 10 people doing something, whatever it is, why be the 11th person? Be the one that doesn't do it. And if everyone's being loud, then use the power of silence, for example. In the same way as if you went to a pitch and everybody was doing mime, you'd go, I think I'll start talking here. I find it hilarious, these people who ostensibly claim to be kind of outlaws and freaks. And you go, but you're just following the person in front of you. You're not doing... you might be doing something different from the guy who works in a bank, but in this little community, you're doing exactly the same as each other. You're exactly the same as the guy with the bowler hat and the umbrella. You're doing exactly that. Yeah. What was the question? I don't know.
Okay. So the other part is just ridiculous stories. I'm sure you have plenty of them.
I'm trying to remember. You see, one of the things which... there was always a little core group of us would book a spot and go out and just play. And it was about making each other laugh. Me and Alex worked together for 8-9 years. I don't think we ever finished a show unless we made each other laugh. I mean, literally, we used to have a little silver cup we found in a junk shop, a little silver cup on a wooden plinth, and we had it in the bag. And if something happened and Alex or I said something that we'd never said before and it was particularly good and it got a big reaction, take the cup out and give it to the other person and shake hands, and it's very, very good. And it was just for us. It was just a gag for us. Before somebody went on to do a show, you'd just say a line, you'd say anything, they're my glasses, or how's your mother, or just something. And you'd say to the other person, you've got to get that line into the show and you've got to get a laugh with it.
And you've got to get a laugh with it. So if you don't get a laugh, you've got to say it again in a different way.
You've got to make it work. And that was like me and Alex Dandridge and Andre Vincent and this guy Eddie Izzard, I don't know whether you know, he's now a comedian. And I remember doing a show with Eddie years ago. It was just about whatever happens. And we would openly, and you know, if there was a crazy person, we would go, fantastic, there's a crazy person. And we would go, come on into our world. And I remember we got this guy out and we didn't get him out. He just appeared. You see, a lot of mad people, they recognize the madness in others and they go, oh, you're like me. And so they're drawn to you. Mm-hmm. And I remember this guy came out and it was hilarious because he was really on the edge of society. I'm on the edge of society. He was further than... But he was covered in tattoos. But before they were sort of popular... He's the first person I'd ever seen tattooed on his face. And it was one of those tattoos that had been done by a friend with like a nail and a bottle of ink. There was no finesse to it.
Yeah.
And he had tattooed permanently on his head two words, eat shit.
Wow.
And it was just fantastic. So we're just kind of... And it was never about trying to making fun of the guy. And so we'd improvise these little scenes of going... Can't help feeling that, you know, this is going to, later on in your life, it's going to affect your career opportunities somewhat. Even if you get highly qualified, which seems unlikely, but even if you do, you're going to go in and have to do these, you know, interviews where they go, well, Mr. Smith, your qualifications are excellent and your demeanor and your experience, but about the, is there anything you could do, a hat or a hairstyle? And it's funny because I remember that particularly because it was exactly the sort of thing which most performers would go, oh, God, some crazy guy on the pitch with a tattoo done. Oh, get him out. And we were like, come on in. Come in. Come join this. You know, those basic rules of improvisation, you know, always saying yes and never saying no, and, you know, yes and, you know, which performers now never do. You never see people playing like that. You never see people going, let's just play. Because they go, no, I could get another show. I could make a bit more money. And you go, yeah, what have you learned? I've learned I need more money for my drugs and my whatever it is. And you go, there's this opportunity to go out and just play and to learn, to find your voice. This is what it's about. This is essentially what being a performer is about. It's about finding your voice. And you can only do that by using your voice, by kind of, maybe I need to be a bit more like, no, maybe I should be a bit more manic. No, maybe that doesn't work for me. Maybe I should be quiet. Maybe this is when you're young and you're starting out, or you don't have to be young, but when you're starting out, it's about finding your voice. But these guys now don't. When I say these guys, I'm talking about that vast majority. And of course, I'm generalizing. And of course, I'm sure there are people who are not doing that. But the general, I just hit my microphone. That general thing of, they don't want to find their voice. They go, you say that line, you do that bit. You say that.
Do you think they're scared of it? Like, maybe, I think there's so many people who are scared of knowing themselves.
Riddled with fear. They're riddled with fear. Of course they are. And the lethal combination of being riddled with fear and also this, I say macho because generally they're men, but even if they're women, this macho thing of, because for them that would appear to be a failure because you went out and didn't make any money. I went out and I didn't make it. Yes, but look what you're doing. You're doing the same old tired nonsense. And you know, and I have no problem if somebody says, I do the same old tired nonsense. I'll never be a great performer. I'm not a comedian. I'm not qualified to do anything else. Or, you know, I could do this job and I could make this much money. Or I could do this and I make more money and I've got a kid to feed. That's fine. I have no problem with that. It's not like I'm saying, no, you have to be an artist. You are or you're not. And if somebody says, oh, I'm just a hack, this is just a way of making money. I just did this show in Amsterdam, and there's this act, Vic and Fabrini, and they've been doing this act for, oh my God, 27 years or something. Same act, 8-10 minutes. They worked at the Crazy Horse in Paris for 17 years, 2 shows a day. They don't speak. It's all to music, 10 minutes. There's no chance to do anything different because it's choreographed and bump it up. And it's great and people love it. And you go, if I did 3 months of that, I'd be signing myself into a mental institution. And then you find out that Fabrini is an amazing painter. And his work is collected around the world. And so for him, what a joy. He does
his day job. He doesn't care. It's his day job.
He paints all day. He makes these beautiful. And he goes, oh, it's time to go in, put the costume on, do 10 minutes, and then go home again. Uh-huh. Well, that's I have no problem with that. That's fantastic. But it's when there's a pretension of being a performer and an artist. And, well, you're not. Clearly, you're not. Because one of the ways of knowing if you're an artist is if you continually try this, that doesn't work, that doesn't please me. Even if it does work, even if it ostensibly does work and it ticks all the boxes that other people have, if it doesn't tick your boxes, then okay, we abandon that and we do something else and we move on and we do that. And it's not about doing it to impress other people or so other people go, oh man, he's fantastic. It's not about that. It's about, I have to please myself. I'm the only person that's ever seen every show I've ever done, you know, and I have to see it, and I have a low boredom threshold, so I have to amuse myself. I have to come off and go, now that's interesting, even if the audience hate it or are indifferent to it. If I come off going, now that's interesting, mm-hmm. that's really interesting, mm-hmm. then that's a success. 99% of everything is terrible, isn't it? 99% of films are bad, 99% of books are bad, and 99% of everything is bad. So most of this stuff is not applicable to most people because most people are rubbish, and so they're just going to kind of do what they do, and it's fine. But if anybody, you know, hears this and thinks, I think I might be in the 1%, but I'm scared to say it, but I think I might be in the 1%, I just wish I was being more eloquent and more direct. There's stuff in there, of course, but it's not like I've spent my life avoiding talking about these things, except to my dearest friends, of whom there are that many, you know. And so we've all known each other for a long time. We have the same shorthand, so we can just talk about these things very easily. But trying to talk about it in a way that, actually, I don't care if people kind of go, what an idiot. But if one or two people kind of go, okay, so maybe I am on the right road, because everyone tells me I'm on the wrong road. That's almost one of the definitions of being on the right road, that you'll be surrounded by people going, you're on the wrong road.
Yeah,
you know, if everyone's going, patting you on the back and going, you're doing great, you're probably not doing that great. It's like when somebody says, trust me. Well, then, of course you don't trust them, because they've just said, trust me. Why would you trust somebody who says, trust me? If people are telling you, yeah, you're doing great, you're probably not doing great, because most people are idiots. And most people watch X Factor and American Idol and all that stuff. And so for them, that's the definition of success. Is, oh, you're on American Idol. Well, I don't care. That's a way of telling you that you're not very good. That's a way of telling you that you're appealing to... You do what you can do. If most people are not destined to do anything great. Most people are destined to be journeymen, workers, and that's why you have to really detach from the ego, because that'll completely derail you, the ego thing. Because you do a show and the people in the audience who are generally part of that 99% of idiots who will go, that's fantastic, and here's some money, and you think, hey, I must be great because people keep telling me how great I am, and woof, and that will completely derail you. And you need to come off after doing a show with people standing and cheering and you've made more money than you can carry, and you need to come off and go, could be better, it's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was great talking to you.
Well, it's nice to meet you. And like I say, I don't know whether any of this will make sense to anybody. But if somebody gets something out of it, then it's worth it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of the other things I think is so cool is putting yourself out there so that people like me can now know you. When you listen to these episodes, you feel like you just made a new friend.
I honestly don't know who does or who will listen to these things. I mean, I don't know. In this situation, I'm not necessarily a crowd pleaser, because I could go, okay, let's just come up with some stories and some quick, but it's, you know, I don't care. I know. It's not a performance for me. You know, I'm not trying to, and it's not about the ego. It's not about trying to make myself look intelligent or clever or experienced, or, you know, it's just the way it is. And oh God, I don't know.
No, it's beautiful and it's perfect. You're great.
Well, God bless you. Not that I'm presuming there's a God, because we know, who knows, but if there is a God, may he or indeed she bless you. Hey, lovely to talk to you, and you appear to be a lovely person, and that's good, because the world needs more of those people.
Agreed.
Right. Feel free to Skype, and I promise I won't bore you with talk of street performing or anything else.
I don't think I looked bored the whole time. I mean,
no, you did a very good job at hiding your boredom by pretending to write. That was an excellent trick.
Tactics.
Take it easy. I hope this makes sense somewhere along the line, and feel free to whatever.
Okay, I will bug you again sometime. Have a good night.
Take it easy.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Stories from the Pitch is produced by the Busker Hall of Fame. Music for today's podcast came from John Feely's partner in the Florists, Dave Southern, and his band Skiffle Disco. Special thanks to Dave for allowing us to use his music. Subscribe to this podcast via iTunes. Just go into the Music Store's podcast section and search for Stories from the Pitch. And while you're there, take a second and post a review. These reviews help with our rankings and visibility in iTunes. If you have musical tracks you'd like us to feature, or are a helpful web genius who noticed something about the Busker Hall of Fame website you think we could improve, or heck, just an opinionated busker with a salty mouth, we want to hear from you. Drop me a line at cbg@buskerhalloffame.com. We also have loads of additional content on our Facebook page at facebook.com/buskerhalloffame. We've recently been posting a ton of pictures of people paying tribute to Robert Nelson by wearing the commemorative Busker Hall of Fame t-shirts. Proceeds from these t-shirts help to fund the ongoing costs of maintaining this project, so consider picking one up for yourself. Complete ordering information is available on the Busker Hall of Fame website. Speaking of remembering Robert, please do call our Remembering the Butterfly hotline at 1-416-613-0003. Stories and memories about Robert that are phoned in will be put into a special commemorative episode that we hope to put out before the end of this year. I was actually in the Vaudeville in the Streets Festival in Toronto that John speaks about in this episode, but it wasn't until 1993 when I got to tour Australia with the Uncles that I really got to know him and his partner Alex and receive my semi-official moniker.
For some reason, me and Alex started calling him Charlie Checkerboard and his Chest of Wonders. I've got to make myself say David Aiken. I know he was young, but from the beginning, I sort of said, this checkerboard thing, I'm not on board with this, David. And he was like, no, but it's a logo. And I said, but you can't base your career on a geometric design. It's clearly nonsense.
On behalf of myself, co-producer Lindsay Lindberg, and the rest of the staff of the Busker Hall of Fame, we hope this finds you well. And as you perform for audiences around the world, please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm Charlie Checkerboard in his Chest of Wonders. Thanks for listening.
Fantastic. He's a crazy person.